So for some years I've taught preaching, the subject of preaching at the college. Not recently, they took me off the list. I'm not sure why. I didn't ask. I wasn't brave enough to. But one of the questions I ask students in the very first lesson, you know, in Preaching 101 is, what's the difference between preaching and teaching? What's the difference between preaching and teaching? I don't know if you have a view on this. Just recently, Sharon and I were listening to a preacher who yelled a lot. And I was saying to Sharon, I think we should try it. I think we should just every now and then, particularly when people are looking comfortable, just yell loudly, perhaps thump the pulpit, which was kind of an image of preaching, I think. I remember when I first started preaching, and I guess I'm what you'd call a conversational preacher. People used to say to me, oh, you're a teacher, not a preacher. And I want to say, look, I just need to clarify this for you. There's a difference between preaching and teaching. So when you're teaching someone, you want them to learn a skill. You want them to gain some knowledge. You want to add something to their repertoire of all sorts of things, right? When you're preaching, the enterprise is different. Your goal is to tell the story of God, right? To tell it and retell it. So we come to church week after week, and you say, well, why would we come? Well, it's a spiritual discipline. We come to the house of God to hear again the story of God. So worship should be shaped like a story too. That calls us to a moment where we respond to the story of God. So preaching really is storytelling, or it should be. So it's not that I want people to take notes and remember facts, but I want them to feel somehow that this story is their story. It's the idea of when you go and watch a movie, which is a story, right? You don't say to people when they come out from a movie, what have you learned? You say, how did you enjoy it? What did you, you know, how did you feel? And people would say, delighted me, it challenged me. I was just so overtaken by the story. So history also, we've begun to learn in recent years, is not just the facts, that history is always a story. And that idea that history is told by the victors, right, in the war, the history of the war. And so history is always a story because it's a selective process. The Gospels too are a story. They're a true story, but they're a story nonetheless. So why did Mark choose this material? Why these miracles? Why these sayings? Why in this order? Why this and not that? And the very art of crafting a story in a particular way tells a story so that our attention is drawn to certain parts of the story, the bits that matter most. And that's what storytelling is. Which facts do you choose? What do you emphasise? So as Lois has told us, Asaph was a leader, a choir leader, essentially a worship leader in the temple of David. And he was a pretty well-known guy. We hear about him, first of all, in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 6. He's a musician in the temple. And this psalm is one of 11 psalms that belong to him or ascribed to him, or at least to his choir or his group that led this worship. And so he was an important figure in the worship of Israel. Now, this particular psalm is a long one. We didn't read all of it. It's the second longest behind Psalm 119. And basically what he says is, listen to me. Listen to my parables. Listen to my sayings. Listen to the stories that we must tell our children and the next generation. And then he goes on for the rest of all the psalm to tell the story of Israel. Now, he kind of tells it, interestingly enough, in an unusual way, and he jumps backwards and forwards chronologically in the story. But that's because he wants to highlight certain aspects of the story, God's love or God's judgment or God's plans for Israel. So in this psalm, there's both instruction and model, right? So we have the instruction where he says, this is what we must do. We must tell it to our children. And then he models that very thing. And he tells the story, basically 500 years of history of the people of Israel. Now, we know that this actually matters to us. It's the story of God that makes us family, that makes us God's family. We know this in our own families, right? Does that I don't know if it happens in your family, when you gather together, you tell stories that you all know, that you've all heard before. Do you do that? What about the time that And everybody remembers. You don't actually need to tell the story again, but you do, or somebody does. All right? Remind you of things that were special or important or meaningful times, and remind you once again that you belong together. These are identifying stories about family. And so storytelling is important to our sense of self and self of who we are, knowing that we belong in the story, in fact, that we have a place there. When I was studying in America, I studied one particular subject about faith formation, particularly faith formation for children. And there was an author called Kathy Stonehouse, who was also a professor there. And we went to her church to participate in experiential learning, to participate in her way of teaching children. And for her, it was about telling a story. It wasn't about the kids learning facts. It was about her goal was how can I tell this story in a way that will delight this 3 or 4 year old child? How can I tell this story in a way that will spark their imagination, that will cause them to wonder? And it was really enlightening to see that. And her idea is that children are born with this sense of imagination, a sense of the great big someone out there. All right? And she says our job is to help them understand that that great big someone out there is the living God, the God that we know and love, the God that we see in Jesus Christ. And so we tell stories that will help them make sense of that, and we'll see that their story belongs in God's story. So the story of God is important to us, for it reminds us of who we are. And that remembering becomes part of our identity, and it shapes our beliefs and it shapes our actions. Because here's the thing, we will hear other stories, won't we? The world will tell us other stories. Our culture will tell us other stories. There'll be other narratives that will seek to shape us. We'll hear stories on the news. We'll hear stories from our friends. We'll hear stories about the way the world is. And we need to be sure in the story, in God's story, of who we are. Otherwise, when we face the same danger as Israel. And Asaph says in verse 11, they forgot the miracles. They forgot the miracles. Because it is possible, you see, it is possible to forget the story. That the story that we heard, the story that we knew, is no longer part of our life. Some years ago, Sharon helped disciple a girl. She became a friend of ours, a very good friend of ours. And she'd had this remarkable encounter with God in an extraordinary way, and she came to faith, and she was a bright, intelligent person, inquiring mind, and wanted to make sense of this experience that she'd had. And you're talking to her some years later, it was obvious that she'd lost her faith, that she no longer believed in God. And I couldn't help but feel that part of that was that she hadn't remembered. She hadn't remembered the miracle of what God had done. Why we need to remind ourselves, you see, the miracle of what God has done. It matters to us. I didn't say this in the first meeting, but I went to Officers Fellowship a few weeks ago, and I was resentful when I went there. I'm just so cross with the Army right now, really, about our whole building project and the restructure and the way it's impacted my family. I was just grumpy. Like, I'm grumpy a lot of the time, but this time I was more grumpy than normal. And it was kind of, I was resisting hearing from God, right? Resisting hearing from God. And in one of the sessions early on, they played a song, and we're going to listen to this same song at the end of our service here. It's called Remember. It's about remembering. Yes, it is true that there are frustrations with the Army. Yes, it is true that there are frustrations with divisional personnel. It is true. But remember. Remember what I've done for you. Remember my great love. Remember I've called you. See, we need to remember. We need to remember. And we need to help those we love remember. We need to help those that we know remember. So we must tell our family story and tell it well to all the generations. And we're always telling and retelling the story to a new generation. Now, the storyline doesn't change, but the way we tell it will. Who remembers flannel graphs? Do you remember those when we used to have... you're nodding. There wasn't a lot of nodding in the 9 o'clock service. Some of them didn't know what I was talking about. You know, when you have the children's story in the holiness meeting And if there's a creative person, they'd bring out the flannel graphs and they'd, you know, green flannel, and there'd always be sheep, because I don't know why, there was always sheep, all right, in the story. We don't need to bring out the flannel graphs, all right? We've got different ways to tell the story now, but it's kind of the same story. We need to think that through, because we need to hold their attention, particularly our younger people. We need to hold their attention. We want them to hear this story and to hear it well. In fact, there's a story in Acts chapter 20. It's Acts 20, verse 9. And it's where Paul is on one of his missionary journeys, and he ends up in a place called Troas, which is in modern-day Turkey, just south of where Gallipoli is. And he met with the Christians there, and they're all gathered and they're all talking, and you probably know this story. And Paul was talking and talking and talking, and it got to about midnight, and there was a young man who was sitting in the window, and he fell asleep. And unfortunately, the window was three stories up, and he fell out of the window, and everybody rushed out and they thought he was dead, and Paul picked him up and said, "No, no, it's okay, he's alive." And I love the phrase, and it actually literally says, "And they were not a little comforted." So I'm sure they're comforted by that. And anyway, Paul goes back upstairs and he keeps talking till dawn. But the question is, how do we stop Eutychus falling out of the window? I'm speaking metaphorically, all right? You understand that, don't you? How do we stop Eutychus falling out of the window? How do we tell the story well to our young people? How do we tell it in a way that stops them falling asleep? How do we tell it so they pay attention? How do we tell it so they can hear it? If you're a student of history, you'll know that we, kind of Western civilization, emerged from the Dark Ages kind of around the 10th and 11th centuries. And that it was kind of an early Renaissance where they rediscovered Latin, they rediscovered Greek, and they started translating old texts that they knew, kind of rediscovered words and rediscovered stories. But it was a long time before those words made their way to the general population. If you were living in Western Europe at that stage, words were few. There weren't many words. Virtually no one in your village could read. The priest had probably learnt Latin, but he probably learnt it by rote. All right? So there weren't many words at all. Fast forward 900 years, we're surrounded by words. There are so many words. We are bombarded with messages and emails and texts and stories and words on the screen. We hear so many words. Some of us listen all day to words on talkback radio, all right? We just hear words, 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 stories, stories, stories. And the question is, how do we make sense of that? And that's the challenge for our young people, isn't it? That's the challenge in the world that they face. How do we help them hear the words that matter? In a world of too many words, how can we help them hear the truest, deepest words, the stories that matter most, the stories that will define their lives? But of course, there's another challenge in telling this story, because we tell this story in both word and deed. And I think, you know, Judith's example of learning from her mum reminds us of that, that we learn by participating in, by sharing in together. So after Paul left Troas, and this is a bit in Acts where he and Luke are travelling together, and they made their way to Ephesus, and then eventually they made their way to Tyre, which is in Palestine. And he met with the church there, which is what he always did. He met with the Christians, and when it came time to say goodbye, they took them back down to the beach, and it says in the scripture that all of them, with the wives and children, took us out to say goodbye. And we all knelt on the beach and prayed. This idea of walking and praying together, so we hear the story, we participate in the story together. Stories are told through seeing, all right? It's not just words. Stories are told through experience. I can still remember quite clearly when I was a boy in Inverell, so this is in the 60s. I can still remember seeing my junior soldier sergeant come to the holiness table and pray in a holiness meeting. I can still remember that. And so why would that image stay with me? Because somehow I thought that's important. You know, here's one of my teachers and she's kneeling in prayer. That tells me something about the story, right? And I have to be there to see that, to experience it. When we were at Chatswood Court, there's a lovely man there called Bob Bannister, and he's quite old now, honestly. And he was telling me about, he grew up in a Salvation Army family, and he's telling me about when he was young, very young boy. One of his earliest memories is going, in the 1920s, he's going with his mum to a congress. And she was in her full uniform with her bonnet on, and they hopped off the tram, and he was holding her hand. And as they started to walk down the street, someone came and asked them for help, saw the Salvation Army uniform, and came and asked them for help. And he said, my mother gave the man some money, and then she knelt in the street and prayed with him. Why would he remember that story all those years later? Why would he remember that story? Well, of course, it mattered. He saw his mum praying. He saw his mum sharing God's love with someone. I mean, how different would his life have been if he'd never heard his mum pray? Is it possible? Is it possible that children would not hear their parents pray in a Christian family? You see, we need intergenerational experiences. Not all the time, but the right amount of time. All right, we need those times when we're all together as God's people. And this has been a big push in the church in recent years to stop the age streaming that separates out the church. So that in very large churches, much bigger than us, where there's thousands of people, that a child will go to the stream for the preschoolers and a stream for the infant's age and a stream for the primary kids and a stream for the worship with the high school age kids, then a stream for the young adults, and then they get to 21 and they turn up in church for the first time with the adults. And they say, this isn't my church. I've never been here before. So there's been pushback from churches saying that the intergenerational stuff, the generations in the same space learning from each other, hearing the story of God together, that it really, really matters. Now, of course, we have to work out how we do that. What's the right amount of time to spend together? I don't think that our young people listen to the sermon all that much. In fact, I surveyed them. We did a survey recently of all our young people, and I was delighted to find that 62% of our young people, high school age, said they sometimes listen to the sermon. 62%. When we did this in the 9 o'clock, I just got everybody to look at them just to see who was actually looking at the time. And some of them were. Some of them were. Marty just laughed when I told him they listened to the sermon. He didn't believe a word of it. What's the right amount of time? What's the right amount of time? What does it look like? How do we shape sermons? How do we shape songs? How do we shape worship in a way that will help our young people hear this story? So they'll hear this story that matters to us, and we want it to matter to them. You see, it's easier for those of us who've known it longer, right? I've known this story for a long time. It's been part of my life for many years. I know this story well. But for some of them, that's not the case. And one of the things they've talked about in this idea of intergenerational church is the church needs to become a third place, or should be a third place. Often it is. This isn't Christian writing. This is a secular guy, a guy called Oldenburg. He wrote this in 1989. He talked about that for most of us, we have three places. We have our home, all right, that's our first place. And we have work or school, and that's our second place. But what most of us want is a third place. A third place where we can gather and we can talk, and these are libraries and these are parks and these are clubs, all right? Third places where they're egalitarian, where everybody's equal, and where conversation is key to what happens. It's actually in some ways about recreating the village, recreating a village so people can learn from each other and participate in life together. Conversation and equality are the key. How do we create a village? I think for many of us who grew up in the Salvation Army, we would understand that the Salvation Army was our third place, wasn't it? Because it dominated our lives. So much of, well, when I was a kid, virtually all of Sunday was given over to life at the core. There'd be two or three nights a week. Often we'd be going to concerts and programs on Saturday nights. I'd core cadets on Friday night. Like, the core was my third place. Right? And we'd want that to be true. We'd want that to be true for all generations now. How do we do that? How do we create spaces? How do we create the village? How do we create it online? How do we create it in person? We can meet each other, all generations, but not in parallel, but as one. Now, this mutual intergenerational idea is not just about teaching young people, but it's actually about all generations talking to each other. It's also about the younger generations helping us to work out the remote control, all right? How to use your iPhone. That's a metaphor too, right? You get that? That it's about how can we learn from them? How can we hear from them? How can we hear their story? How can we tell them our story? How do we do that? How do we reshape our life as a church? And I don't know. But I think we've got to work it out. Because we must make sure we tell the story best to those who know it least. We must make sure we tell the story best to those who know it least. You see, the Christian story, the story of God and his people, is a familiar one to me. I've known it for many years. It has defined my life. But my children? Not quite so much. How can we make forming our generations, telling our story to the generations, at the centre of what we do as a core? What do I need to change in my preaching, in the way I tell the story? One of the things I talk about when I teach preaching is every sermon's meant to have a purpose, right? Why are you telling this story in this way? What's it meant to do? Is it meant to challenge people? Is it meant to encourage people? Is it meant to rebuke people? What's it meant to do? What we're talking about today, I think, is a challenge for us. See, honestly, this has been an unexpected year for us. We thought that right now we'd be opening our new building in 426 Church Street. We've got this unexpected year when yet again we're in a temporary accommodation that makes it very difficult for us to gather. But I don't think this should be a year when we spin our wheels, all right? Where we just do nothing, where we just hold on. I think we can do better than that. If I can change the metaphor, I think this is the year where we fill our sails ready for the rolling start. We watch the start of the Sydney to Hobart. You know, where the yachts do that thing where they go round so they're ready to cross the start line at just the right time with the wind in their sails, a running start. I think that's our goal here. So we cross the start line when we go into our new building, renewed and recalibrated, to tell our story to each other and to the world in a new place and in a new way. But also to tell the story to ourselves, to know more and more our own place in the story, because each of us has a place in God's story. Each of us is needed to tell God's story. Every generation, every person helping to shape a new story. We become and are becoming a people of God more and more by telling the story of his great love to every generation. We become and are becoming a people of God more and more by telling the story of his great love to every generation. And when we've told the story well, when the story is as familiar as breathing, as familiar as our own name, we remember. And we remember when we doubt and we pray, show me. We remember in our joy and we whisper, thank you. We remember in our pain and we plead, help me. We remember in our hopes and we say, lead me. We become and are becoming a people of God by telling the story of his great love to every generation. God, help us to be faithful in the telling. So I want us to listen to this song to help us remember this idea of remembering all that God has done for us. And as we do so, there's going to be words from the Psalms that talk about either telling the story or talk about the generations, our responsibility for the generations. How the story is passed down through the generations. So let's take a moment to respond, to hear God's voice, to respond to his spirit, to allow the scripture and the words of this song to minister to us right now.